So how many of you woke up this morning and thought, BRE Forum, got to be there? Okay. Yeah, me too. Well, good afternoon. My name is Wayne Bell, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to the Bureau's Forum. I want to express my deep thanks to the California Association of Realtors for inviting us to the Realtor Expo and for providing us with this wonderful venue. And I want to say that my colleagues and I are very, very pleased that you could join us here this afternoon. In somewhat short order, I will introduce the Bureau's entire executive committee, with the sole exception of Chris Neary, who heads up our subdivisions unit. He couldn't be here with us today. And then I'll introduce the speakers for the forum and some other key members of the Bureau team. I believe that it's important for you to meet our team and for you to know them and all of the key players. But first, I'd like to acknowledge my good friend, Pat Neal, who's up in the second row here. Pat is a former colleague of mine at the Business Transportation and Housing Agency, good friend and frequent mentor to me. We served together under Governor Gray Davis, and she, as you know, was formerly president of the California Association of Realtors. Pat. I also want to acknowledge Don Fott, your president this year, who's sitting over in the first row here. As I crisscross the state, I see Don at so many different venues. We've spoken together. We spoke in San Jose recently, not at the same time. He got a great welcome. I'm told they played Gangnam Style for him. I didn't get that sort of welcome. But what's great about Don is he's really the consummate professional, as you know. He loves and exudes enthusiasm regarding the real estate industry, and he represents the California Association of Realtors very well. I also would like to say a few words about the late LaFrancis Arnold, and he was the president, as you know, before Don took over. I think about LaFrancis often, and especially when I think about meetings of the California Association of Realtors. I will always remember his generous and steadfast support of the Department of Real Estate and then the Bureau of Real Estate, of me, and his outstanding service to the real estate industry, the consumers, and to the community. And those of you who knew LaFrancis knew his cheerfulness and a great smile that he had, which would just lighten up an entire room. Now, moving forward, I know those of you who attended our meeting in Monterey, I shared with you all a cartoon from the Cat in the Hat book. And I was the cat in that cartoon, and the cat was balancing everything you can imagine. It's balancing plates and balancing a fishbowl with goldfish and a whole bunch of other stuff. And the cat represented what I'm doing as well as our executive committee in trying to address what we have as a workload at the Bureau of Real Estate. As you know, we have three bodies of law that we enforce. The first is the real estate law, and that's the one that you're primarily familiar with, and that deals with the licensing, regulation, and enforcement of real estate salespersons and brokers, as well as mortgage loan originators who happen to have an endorsement of a real estate license. And that is sort of the beginning of what we do. We've got the three bodies of law, the real estate law, we've got the Subdivided Lands Act, and that's the law that says that anyone who subdivides five or more lots, units, or parcels for sale, lease, or financing has to come and get a public report for us. Then we also oversee the Vacation Ownership and Timeshare Act, and that's the law that deals with timeshares in the state of California. But in addition to that, we're trying to figure out what to do with a changing workload that we're seeing. Now, in a little bit, Jeff Mason, who is our chief deputy, is going to give you our operations report. He's going to include financial information, what we're doing, but I kind of want to give you a quick overview and snapshot of what we're seeing. We're experiencing right now an increase in the scheduling of real estate license exams. And you might imagine that's because people are reading in the paper and they're hearing media reports that the real estate market is getting better. So we see a commensurate number of people applying for real estate licenses. When those people pass their license, they're also going to apply for applications and they're going to obtain their license. So we have an increase in that regard. As far as a snapshot of the current universe, and I don't know how many of you know exactly how many licensees there are in the state. At some point, you'll remember there were about 552,000. That was at the height of the market. As of yesterday morning, the number I got was 408,253 licensees statewide. And then we also have 25,746 mortgage loan broker endorsees. Then, because the market also is seeing an uptick, the developers are looking at creating more housing, which is a good thing for the industry. But we're seeing a large increase in the number of applications we're getting there. In fact, it's 40% year to date. And from July 1, 2012 to 3/31 of this year, our subdivisions unit reviewed 1,942 files, and that's with a staff of 38, including 8 dedicated to reviewing HOA budgets. And our head of subdivisions, Chris Neary, tells me that we'll probably have 3,000 public report filings by mid-2014. So that's a tremendous increase in the number of applications for public reports. Then we've seen a large increase in the number of consumer recovery account applications and payouts. And we have a significant number of routine investigations and audits underway. And Dan Sondry will talk about more of that later. And then, as you know, and I've spoken around the state on this, we still have a very large inventory of cases in our enforcement portfolio as well as our legal portfolio. When I last looked, Tom Poole and I looked, Rick Fong and I looked, we had about 3,500 enforcement cases and about 2,000 cases in our legal unit. And so what we're trying to do is figure out how to best orchestrate, balance, and calibrate what we have going on. Sadly, fraud continues to be in the front of what we do. We've seen fraud, as you know, in the area of short sales. We see it in online rental scams. We're seeing timeshare resales. And then in Dan's area, which is audits, we're seeing a lot of conversions of trust funds. And I was thinking last night about that quote that says there are only two certainties in life, death and taxes. Well, I would add fraud as a third certainty. As I mentioned a moment ago, what we're trying to do, and it's our effort, it's what we are focused on every day as stewards of the Bureau of Real Estate, is to figure out the best way that we can focus on the largest and most substantial problems first and really prioritize what we do. Our fundamental objective is to streamline and improve what we do, manage the greatest risk to public protection, orchestrate all the moving parts, and most prudently assign our limited resources. Now, you'll remember at our last meeting, we didn't have a full executive team. In fact, when I spoke with you, we did not have a chief of enforcement. We did not have a chief counsel. Tom Poole was sort of the acting chief of everything. And we had Jeff Mason here. Well, so far, we've been very lucky in the last several months. We've gotten a new chief of enforcement, and we have a new chief counsel. The other moving part that I mentioned to you in our last meeting is that we were going to move into a new Sacramento headquarters office. Those of you who will remember our old office remember what sad state it was in. It was not well in any regard. The restrooms didn't work well, the lighting didn't work, and so after a long, long look, the Department of General Services located another building for us, and we moved into that building over the weekend of July 30th. And so on July 1st, we moved into a building across the street from Cal Expo. And that's our new headquarters, and we invite all of you who would travel to Sacramento, would like to see our office, to take a tour. The good news is with the opening of our fifth office, with the opening of the Sacramento office, we now have electronic examination sites in every city or every area where we have offices. As you know, we have offices in San Diego, Los Angeles, Oakland, Fresno, and Sacramento. The Los Angeles exam center is in La Palma. We have one in San Diego. And now in Sacramento, we have an exam center in our building. And that allows people to come in, sit in front of a computer, take the test. If they pass, they get their score that day. If they've applied a combo app, they can actually get their license that day if there are no other issues. Now, moving onward and onto the agenda of the program, I'd like to introduce my colleagues from the California Bureau of Real Estate who are with me today. Jeff Mason to my left, he's our Chief Deputy Real Estate Commissioner. You met him last time. He was appointed by the governor on April 5th and started his work with the Bureau in May. As you remember, he came to us from his position as Chief of the Bureau of Security and Investigative Services at the Department of Consumer Affairs. Now, Tad Igawa, who is the second, he's raising his hand there, he's our new chief counsel. He was appointed by the governor in June and began with us on July 1st. Before his appointment, Tad was a deputy attorney general at the California Department of Justice, and he was there since 2009. Before that, he was a lawyer at some very fine law firms and also practiced as assistant general counsel at the Ryland Group, which is a large developer and a new home builder. And he was there from 2004 to 2007. Tad has become our go-to source for all of our legal matters, and his solid advice, breadth of knowledge, and lawyering skills are crucial to me and the Bureau. And of critical importance to me is the fact that he likes Diet Dr. Pepper. And he always keeps us well stocked. Now, but Tad, I only have water today, so.
I'll fix it.
Okay, thank you. And then next to Tad, and it's to your left, is Rick Fong. And Rick, did you raise your hand? Rick is our new Bill Moran. As you knew, Bill Moran was with us for about 31 years. Bill retired in December of last year. And we had a huge, huge gap. Tom was gracious enough to step up and help us with the enforcement unit. And yet I want to say I'm very pleased that Rick was appointed. Rick has extensive investigative and enforcement experience, including experience in resolving complaints. Before coming to work with us on July 1st, Rick was a program chief and manager of complaint resolution program at the Department of Consumer Affairs. Prior to that, Rick provided service as an acting bureau chief, deputy chief, a supervisor, and an enforcement team leader at different bureaus under the Department of Consumer Affairs. He began his state career in 1993, some 20 years ago, investigating complaints for the Bureau of Automotive Repairs and was involved in undercover investigations and unlicensed activity sweeps in that position. You will hear from Rick a little later about our enforcement program and some of the plans that he and we have for a more efficient, effective, and proactive enforcement unit, including plans for a statewide unlicensed activities unit and a more vibrant complaint resolution program. Then we have Tom Poole. Tom is at my far left and your far right. Tom, if you could raise your hand. Good, good, good. Tom's been with the department and now Bureau a total of 28 years, going on 29 years. And for those of you who came to our meetings while we were a department, you'll know Tom as our legislative deputy as well as our public information officer. Tom no longer handles those roles, but the good news is that Tom is now our point person for licensing and administrative services, and that includes mortgage lending activities and supervision of our licensing and education units. His knowledge, experience, and cautious counsel is invaluable to me and to the Bureau. Then there's Dan Sondre. Dan, if you raise your hand. Dan is our chief auditor, and as you'll remember, he replaced Fauci Lin. I know many of you knew Fauci and loved to hear him talk about the cases we had. Dan will be giving you an audit report and will be sharing information about an exciting new educational tool on trust fund handling and reconciliations. Dan started with the department about 25 years ago as an auditor in San Francisco, and he's truly a consummate professional. Now, Dan usually has some hidden gems of humor in all of his presentations, always has those hidden gems. And so be certain to listen very carefully to uncover those. I now have some final introductions of some folks from Sacramento. First, our Sacramento-based staff, and just so you know, if you ever come to Sacramento and come to our executive unit, these are the folks you're going to see, including the folks I'm going to introduce you to now. And the two women I'm about to introduce, I have to say, we could not survive without them. We could not do what we do without their assistance. First, I'm going to introduce Ginger Allison. Ginger, if you could stand up and wave. Ginger is Tad's executive assistant and our liaison to our statewide legal unit, but Ginger has been helping me since I became commissioner. And her assistance has been great. And I have to say, I can't thank her enough for her support, her kindness, and all the things she does to assist me. And her work is always professional. Then we also have with us Ro Baden-Distel. And Ro, if you could stand up and wave. Ro hates this, but... Ro works in our executive office along with Ginger and provides us all with great and strident and steadfast assistance. And I'm really happy she could be with us today as well. Now, we also, usually we don't have our staff come with us. And this time I wanted you to get a sense of the terrific staff that we have. So we invited a number of our staff members today, and I invite you to talk with them after this session, ask them what they do, get their cards. And the point that I want to make to all of you is we want to be as transparent as we can. We want to be good government for you. In fact, there's a great quote that I heard years ago that always intrigued me. There was a senator named Herman Talmadge from, I think it was Georgia, and there was a quote that was attributed to him, and he said something like, "For our friends, there's good government. For everybody else, there's just government." Well, the bottom line here is we want there to be good government for everybody. And when I talk about good government, I'm talking about efficient, effective, transparent, where we interact with you. We're not trying to play any games. We want to be the best stewards, the best folks that we can be as far as helping you take on the bad folks in the real estate industry, because it is your industry and only working with you and together with us that we can do what we need to do, especially in the area of unlicensed activity. And so I invite you to get to know our staff, and if you're ever in Sacramento, come by and say hello. Now, with regard to our Los Angeles staff, I'm going to ask them to either they can stand or wave or whatever you'd like to do. First, I'd like to introduce Phil Idy. Now, a number of you may know Phil. Phil is our senior most manager in our Los Angeles office. Phil is a regional manager. He covers what we call our Los Angeles North Division as well as Fresno. And Phil has been with us for a long time, and he's given great service to the department and now the Bureau for many, many years. And I really want to say he's served us well. Now, I don't know, is Maria Suarez here? No, okay. Maria Suarez is not here. Veronica. Is Veronica here? Okay, well, Veronica, if she had been here, I would have. She's in our San Diego office, so I understand the difficulty in coming up here. She's our San Diego regional manager. She's also one of our law enforcement liaisons. She was going to be here, and if you're ever down in San Diego, that's the person to see. Now, Anthony Vo is here, right? Yeah, there's Anthony. This is Anthony. He's a manager in our Los Angeles South unit, and LA South is primarily Orange County. And it also includes some of the Inland Empire, I know. And Anthony's, like I said, a manager in our Los Angeles South unit. He's also a law enforcement liaison for the Bureau. And that means he reaches out to various task forces on real estate fraud, mortgage fraud. And so I want to welcome Anthony. We also have with us Summer Bakatich. Summer, if you could raise your hand, stand up and wave. Summer is a special investigator in our Los Angeles North unit. She's also a law enforcement liaison for the Bureau. And she's served with great distinction as a co-chair of a special advisory committee on policy improvement and innovation that I formed. And she's been very proactive in providing me with innovative, creative ideas to make us better and to add value in what we do for the public. We also have Carlo Banky. Carlo, do you want to wave? Carlo is a special investigator in our Los Angeles office as well, and Carlo is in our advocate program. He is an advocate, and we also have Gino D'Agnino, who I'll introduce in a moment. Both Gino and Carlo do advocacy work for us, and that's the name that we now have attributed to our complaint resolution program, and Rick's going to talk more about that later. But one thing that we know that will help the industry, and we want to really embolden this effort and roll it out more and have it more vibrant, is to have a complaint resolution program where we reach out to a respondent, someone who has been the subject of a complaint, see if that complaint can be resolved short of disciplinary action, short of any punitive action by us or anyone else, to see if we can do a win-win for both the complainant as well as the respondent. So Carlo is doing that, and then Gino Dagnino. Gino, if you could stand up. His real name is actually Ray, but he goes by Gino, right? And Gino is also a very, very good advocate, and he's in our Los Angeles office. Now, the time allotted for our presentation is about 1 hour and 30 minutes. And our plan is to finish early so that we can hear from you. We know what we think. We talk to each other every day. We work with each other. We know what we think, but we want to hear from you because you are the ones who are out there in the field. You're talking with people. You know what's happening. And the only way that we can be proactive is from hearing your stories, what you know, and then by you sharing with us the issues that you see and you'd like to see addressed. Now, as part of any give and take that we do in the the after part of our presentations, I would like to invite you, as leaders of the real estate industry, which you all are, to share any ideas you have regarding what we can do to improve our services, to positively shape the Bureau, to add value to you and to the public, and to be more relevant in serving and protecting the public and promoting a fair, lawful, and when I say lawful, I mean law-abiding and competent marketplace for real estate professionals. Now, with that, I'm going to end my comments, and I'll get back up here at the end so we can address your concerns. But right now, I'd like to invite Jeff Mason up here to give the operations report. Thank you.
Afternoon, everyone. This is a really interesting, unique event. As Wayne mentioned, I was part of Department of Consumer Affairs before I came over to then Department, now Bureau of Real Estate. And this is a forum we just did not really do. We did not talk directly to our customers and get the feedback back and forth. This really reminds me more of my private sector days working with shareholders, business owners, our customers, trying to have a much more established transparency in what we do and how we're doing, as well as getting a feedback going back and forth. You know, there's a lot of, as folks probably know, there's a lot of change going on in the world of the Bureau, the department, whatever you want to call us. We have new initials. We are a department / a Bureau. It's all moving around, new buildings, new people. And change, of course, freaks people out. I remind people, change is one of those few times in life that opportunity erupts. When things are up in the air, you can kind of remake things. You can look at things. So this group and our folks here, you know, all 300-plus employees of the now Bureau, we're really trying to move forward and look for new ways, new creativity. How can we do the same things differently? Are we doing the things we should be? Are we doing things we shouldn't be doing? And that's really been the message that the commissioner has brought forward to all of us. And everyone seems very, very excited about relooking everything we do. We're trying to be kind of MacGyvers. To give you an analogy, and I'm going to show you this because when I go home and show my wife this, she's going to roll her eyes at me. But I think it's way cool. This morning, going to the airplane, my jacket got caught, and I ripped off my button. Curses. Mainly because I knew I was going to lose that button within the next 5 minutes. I found a paperclip, jabbed it through, and it's on there. Nobody said my wife's going to roll her eyes at me. I thought it was pretty cool and pretty smart. But that's really an approach that we're all trying to use here. There's so many amazing resources that the Bureau has as far as intellect and experience and what you guys have brought to us. But we're now trying to figure out, can we do things with paperclips? Can we do things with moving people around? So as I go through a whole bunch of numbers that may make you glaze over, I will try to bring relevance to them. We're going to talk about, you know, this was last year and the previous years, and how does this tie forward as we go forward, you know, in the spirit of change and opportunity. So I'm going to click here. So some financial numbers. In years past, this was like a month-by-month thing. What this is this fiscal year 12-13. The state's similar to a lot of businesses in that our fiscal year runs from July 1 of the year through June 30th of the next year. So this was 12-13, those periods. Here's our revenue, our expenditures, and our reserves. To kind of make this down into a simple sentence, what this means is reserves, we have about almost 9 months of operating budget in a reserve. In other words, if all the money stopped coming in, we'd still be able to operate for about 9 months. And that's typically what they like in government in agencies. As you can see, there is an ebb and flow, and that's really based around licensing fees coming in. There is no, you have peaks of renewals, peaks of licensing times, et cetera. Expenditures last year were a little higher than normal because of the move to the new building. It was a big thing. Just so you know, a lot of that was funded by a special funding from legislature that did not come directly from the operating budget, et cetera. Fiscal year comparisons, and so you can see there the 12-13 fiscal year and the 12-11 fiscal year. As you can see, the difference in the expenditures, once again, that's really around moving the headquarters to a brand new building after 20-plus years in the Broadway building. And Wayne was understating how petrified that building had become. We had mushrooms growing. Bathrooms weren't working. It was an interesting place to be. But in this move, you think about it, it's a great time to move. Rental rates are low. So it kind of worked out for everyone. Revenues are starting to go up. We're starting to see more applications for licensing, more exam requests. We're seeing a growth in folks renewing their licenses. We're going to be talking about some indicators that seem to talk about optimism going forward. And one of those is revenues are going up, more exams, more renewals, et cetera. License population. This goes from on your far left back to 04, 05, all the way through 12-13. As you can see, there's been a bit of an ebb and flow. I'm told back in the high point of 4-5, the number of folks used was there was one in every 50 Californians had a real estate license. Of course, that's not accurate because some of those were business licenses, et cetera. But in kind of a symbolic number, it was one in 50. You take today's numbers, the 408,000 that Wayne mentioned, today's population, you're looking at about 1 in 93 Californians have a real estate license. So to kind of give you a comparison there. Licensing workload. This is, Commissioner Bell mentioned, we have three primary programs. The one, and this is the group that you guys interact with. You interacted with them when you got your license. You interact with them when you renew your license. This is the folks that do all of all that activity, and it's all broken down. As you can see, it's a comparison in the gold of 11-12 and the blue 12-13, and the numbers for most areas are going up. To kind of make that a little more, and then number of licenses issued, the closest 12-13 is over here on the right. You can see if we were a business, the numbers would not be good. If you look back back in 04-05, we issued 76,000 licenses that year. Last year, though, the numbers are starting to go up. We issued 20,000 licenses, and if you look at first quarter results this year, if it continues the same, we're going to have another pop of about 3-4% over last year. Licenses issued over last fiscal year, we went up almost 12%, so that's an optimistic sign. Over the last 3 years, we've gone up 2.6, so almost 3%. But you can see over the last 5 years, a negative 5.9. So the indicators are starting to move to where we as an agency need to start looking at what do we need to do to start forecasting license work. Do we need to look at staffing, technology? How are we going to manage the growth in new licenses, the growth in renewals, and the growth in exams? Exams administered. 12-13, we did about 33,000 exams administered. As you can see, there's a nice piece of growth going on there. It's nothing compared back to 4-5, 5-6, you can see, back in the boom. There's been some conversation. I hear folks, do we do exams fast enough? Just to kind of give you an idea of our current exam capacity. We have about 300 seats statewide, and we can for exams at the electronic testing. We can do two tests a day, so that's 600. We can do, if you remove 2 weeks of each year for holidays, et cetera, we can do about 150,000 exams a year right now. That's our current exam capacity. If you go back to whenever 5645, Tom tells me they were renting out gymnasiums, halls, to hold those. But our numbers would need to grow almost 4.5%, times 4.5% to ever get to our current capacity. Yes, ma'am?
Right. Right.
Gotcha.
Right.
Yeah, and if you look at, once again, if you look at the last 3 months, the first quarter of this fiscal year, I was doing some math this morning. We're going, if it continues at the same rate, we're going to grow about 14% this current fiscal year over last fiscal year. So there's a lot of indicators, once again, of optimism, growth, et cetera. So over the last fiscal year, we grew 24.5%. That's 11-12 to 12-13. Over three fiscal years, we grew 8%. Last five fiscal years, exams administered grew 4%. And I know there's a discrepancy between licenses issued and exams administered. That's because our test isn't very easy. It takes many folks several attempts to pass the test. I'm sure you guys all got it first time in this room. But the MLO endorsements, this is a comparison of 11-12 to 12-13. You can see that there's the numbers don't really, the bars don't really do justice to the, yeah, and It looks like a huge number and a small number, but as you can see, they're very, yeah. So always read the labels, never just look at the slides. Yes. Subdivisions. As Commissioner Bell mentioned to you, we have this, we have a part of the Bureau that does a public report for subdivisions. As you can see, the over 11-12, we're starting to see a large uptick. To kind of put some relevance behind this number, because I'm sure many folks are kind of going, yeah, who cares? What that 2098, what those numbers indicate, that's about 28,000 new planned units that are going to be constructed and built. That's what the 12-13 number resulted in. During the heyday, a public report often was covered a larger development, therefore a large number of houses, but what this gives us right now, it's a little over 28,000 new units will be constructed with that 2098. And this is the area that we're really starting to see a big uptick in work. Developers are becoming more optimistic. Funding's starting to come back into the market, and we're starting to see a lot of projects that had been abandoned being revived, Frankenstein style. And you're seeing a lot of new activities as well. So the numbers continue to go up. It's not a slide for this, but I'll kind of give you an idea of what I keep talking about, the optimism indicators. So over the last 3 years, exams have gone up 8%. Agent renewal rates have gone up 10%. Broker renewal rates have gone up 3%. And our new subdivision reports have gone up 36%. So if you look at over the last 3 years, things are starting to point in the right direction. The market's starting to come around. The work of the Bureau, the department start to increase. Hopefully that means your guys' volume is increasing as well. Let's go back to this. Enforcement. This gives you a comparison year over year of the results of our enforcement activity. You see outright revocations, you see revocations, restrictions, licenses surrendered, license suspended. When Rick Fong gets up and talks, he'll be talking about a lot of these numbers, as well as new ways that we're going to be looking at enforcement. In the past, the enforcement had in most cases worked a lot of been complaint driven. There wasn't a lot of proactive activity. We're trying to move to a model, especially in the area of unlicensed activity, where we're going to be more proactive. We're going to have a task team that actually looks for this stuff, and Rick I'll get into that more directly. So I'm going to hand this over now to Dan Sandry. Dan is he's the funny guy that the commissioner mentioned. So,
well, thank you, Jeff, and good afternoon, everyone. So Wayne mentioned I'm supposed to have hidden gems, and Jeff just put more pressure on me. And, you know, as an auditor, I'm used to being on the other side of pressure, so to have the pressure put on me, I don't know if I like that. So, but anyway. the funny thing is I walked into Rick's office yesterday, and I said, you know, Rick, I don't have a lot of humor in this. It's pretty serious stuff. I got a lot to present here, so I'm going to hand that on to you. Feel free to pass that on to the Q&A session if you don't have the humor either. my initial thought was to talk about trust and reconciliation because, you know, as you know, we've just been through tough times with a lot of bad behavior by unlicensed people and some licensed people as well, a lot of competition for work. And, you know, heck, our U.S. Senate and House of Representatives can't even get along because of the lack of these two virtues. But I'm not going to talk about that. Instead, I'm going to talk about trust fund handling and trust account reconciliation. And maybe not as exciting, but it'll keep our blood pressures down. In addition to performing audits, the audit section is developing educational materials to help real estate licensees better understand the real estate law and the commissioner's regulations, and to avoid common violations that get them in trouble. Our focus is on getting the truly bad characters out of the business and on providing helpful materials to those who wish to operate correctly. First of all, on the subject of performing audits, in the fiscal year just ended on June 30th, 2013, our 30 auditors completed 763 audits. 64% of these audits were investigative audits, which are audits initiated based on a complaint or on information that the department receives, or the Bureau receives. The remaining 36% of audits closed were routine audits, which are audits initiated by the audit section and proactively focused on brokers who handle a lot of trust funds. Of these 763 audits, 178 of them had findings of trust fund shortages, with these shortages collectively totaling over $6,500,000. The great majority of these shortages were found on property management audits, followed by mortgage loan and broker escrow audits. In the fiscal year just ended, half the audits performed were property management audits. 22% were mortgage loan audits, 21% of the audits were audits of sales activities, and 7% were broker escrow activities audits. For your information, the sales audits would have been investigative audits and may have been performed in conjunction with an investigative audit of property management activities or broker escrow or mortgage loan activities. Now, on the education fund, there is much that audits can do to assist licensees in learning the law and coming into compliance with its mandates. Well beyond handing out trust fund materials and references on our audits, we are writing articles and developing presentations that real estate licensees and their employees can use to learn how to operate properly. Upcoming real estate bulletin articles will cover use of payment processing companies, how to properly designate a trust account, and what to do if a bank account used for trust fund handling is levied by a broker's creditor. And unfortunately, this does happen. To help you always be prepared in the event one of our auditors gives you a call one day, I urge you to check out the Bureau of Real Estate website. One longstanding and yet still very relevant educational piece on our website is the 10 most common violations found in DRE audits. This document describes violations we find on audits and how to prevent the violations from occurring in the first place. So 7 of the top 10 violations found on audits relate to trust fund record keeping and trust fund handling. So if you handle trust funds, that should be a major focus, as it is our focus on audits. Here's an even bigger statistic for you, and one that underlines the importance of being educated about trust fund handling. Last year, 40% of our closed disciplinary action cases against licensees were centered on trust fund mishandling. Now, that includes the rap cases that we do where, you know, somebody's been convicted of a crime. So 40% is a huge number. These trust fund mishandling cases are avoidable. A broker must be well-versed in proper trust fund handling and record-keeping procedures if he or she is in business that involves trust fund handling. So I urge you to go to our website. And when you get to our website, look at to the real estate business resources section. And it's at the location of the red arrow here. And note that we put it under essential information. So when you click on the real estate business resources, you find resources such as the 10 most common violations found on audits document. There's a broker self-evaluation there. There are licensee advisories and alerts posted there. And at the bottom, where the red arrow shows, I want to alert you to a PowerPoint presentation that was put together and narrated by one of our Sacramento auditors by the name of Karina DeSonneville. When you click on the trust account reconciliation PowerPoint link there, you get this. It's called Trust Account Reconciliation, the Why, What, and How To. This presentation provides a visual and auditory walkthrough of both the bank account reconciliation process, which is like the checkbook reconciliation that hopefully we all do to our bank statements, and the reconciliation of records process. The reconciliation of records process is the reconciliation required by the Commissioner's Regulation 2831.2 and is greatly misunderstood, and it's a very frequent audit violation. It was a violation on 25% of our audits in the last fiscal year, and many of these audits were, you know, involved some audits where there wasn't a trust account, some of those incidental audits. So, again, a very frequent violation. If your business handles trust funds through a trust account, watching and listening to this PowerPoint is a must-do for you and for your accounting personnel. It walks you through the required accounting records that must be maintained, the reconciliation processes, and what to do if things aren't balancing out. And here's a little example of what the PowerPoint covers.
The topics we'll cover today include the actual language of Commissioner's Regulation 2831.2, titled Trust Account Reconciliation, including details regarding the record of trust funds received and disbursed, and the separate records for each beneficiary or transaction, which are Commissioner's Regulations 2831 and 2831.1, respectively. We will also compare a bank account reconciliation to a 2831.2 trust account reconciliation. Following that, we'll cover how to complete a bank account reconciliation consisting of the adjusted bank balance and the adjusted book balance. Then we'll discuss what a trust account reconciliation consists of, including how to calculate the trust fund liability, and we'll go over in more detail the requirements of the trust account reconciliation record. Lastly, we'll tie the bank account reconciliation and the trust account reconciliation together.
So that kind of covers, you know, initially it just tells you what's going to be covered. And I think it sounds great, and you can right-click on the presentation and save it wherever you want, and, you know, download it. And I'm going to show you some, but by no means all the presentation, you know, just because I want to keep the excitement level down. The presentation visually and in narrated fashion walks the observer step by step through the trust account records that need to be maintained, starting with the record of all trust funds received and dispersed that's shown here. And, you know, by the way, I've removed the narration and the steps from these slides. But, it then goes through the requirements related to separate records for each beneficiary in a step-by-step manner and points the observer towards helpful links. And then the presentation compares the reconciliation to the bank statement on the left with the trust account reconciliation of records that is required by Commissioner's Regulation 2831.2 on the right. The presentation narrates you through the process of completing a bank reconciliation where the end result is a comparison of the adjusted bank balance to the adjusted book balance of your records. It shows the observers what to do if at the end of the reconciliation the adjusted bank balance and the adjusted book balance don't match. And then it gets into the matter of Commissioner's Regulation 2831.2, the regulation with the requirements that are so frequently not met, as follows.
So now we finally get to the topic of this presentation. Remember that the trust account reconciliation is a reconciliation of the sum of all separate records to the balance of the control record. It's important to use the same cutoff date that you used when completing the bank account reconciliation. Just like any bank account reconciliation, the trust account reconciliation can be thought of as a snapshot of a specific point in time.
Okay, so the presentation then walks the observer through the steps of determining the trust fund liability, which is the cumulative amount that you should have on hand for your client beneficiaries. It shows you what is a negative beneficiary balance and provides you an example of how this can happen. And then it shows you how a negative beneficiary balance affects the trust fund liability balance. And then how the negative beneficiary balance is to be presented in the trust account reconciliation. In other words, how the reconciliation would look with a trust fund shortage due to negative beneficiary balances. Finally, the narrated presentation ties together the bank reconciliation shown on the top of the following slide with the Regulation 2831.2 reconciliation as follows.
Referring back to the beginning of the presentation, when we discussed the requirements of the trust account reconciliation report that are listed in Regulation 2831.2, those requirements include that the reconciliation must be completed at least once per month and a record must be maintained. You must identify the bank account name and the number, the date of the reconciliation, and then the beneficiary or transaction identifier, such as an account number or name. And then you're going to also list the trust fund liabilities of the broker to each of the beneficiaries or transactions. And there is a similar example available on our website, and the link is also provided.
So I know this is exciting stuff. I hope you don't go comatose on me, but I cannot encourage this enough. If you handle trust funds through a bank account, you need to do your monthly reconciliations between the accounting records and the bank statement, and then you need to do this required reconciliation. If you don't handle trust funds, well, tell a friend who does. And what can happen if a real estate broker who handles trust funds does not perform the required reconciliations and fails to really get involved with overseeing what is going on in the trust account? Well, there's so many audit cases I can choose from, and this is but one of them. So we audited a corporate real estate licensee that was owned 100% by a real estate salesperson. The business activity of this licensee was property management of 169 properties with annual trust fund collections of over $3 million. The auditor met with the designated officer, the salesperson owner, and a recently hired bookkeeper, and we'll call her Bookkeeper Jones, during the audit. The audit revealed that there were shortages totaling about $6,400 in bank accounts due largely to unidentified causes, The causes could not be determined fully because the accounting records were not accurate. And furthermore, because of accounting errors in the accounting records, these records had not been reconciled to the bank statements. So in addition, the record of all trust funds received and dispersed had not been reconciled to the separate records for each beneficiary transaction, which is a violation of Regulation 2831.2. The salesperson owner and bookkeeper Jones stated that the corporation would be in the process of internally auditing their records over the next couple of months. They said they would review each owner's accounts and calculate the correct amount owed to each owner and make the accounts whole. At the end of the auditor discussed each of the violations with the designated officer, with the salesperson owner, and with bookkeeper Jones. So the end result of this was a hearing wherein the corporation and designated officer received license suspensions on terms and conditions, including payment for the cost of the audit. Unfortunately, the promises made by the designated officer, salesperson owner, and bookkeeper Jones were just that, only promises. After the audit, the absentee designated officer did not ensure that records were reconciled and did not step up supervisory procedures. Perhaps bookkeeper Jones, as part of internally auditing the accounts, saw opportunity instead because she began to embezzle money within 6 months of the closing of our audit. When another complaint came in a couple of years later to the Bureau of Real Estate from a follow-up bookkeeper, one of our auditors went back out there, and we found that the salesperson owner had signed blank trust account checks so that the bills could be paid by the bookkeeper while the owner was away. And, why not just have the designated officer sign them in person? Oh, yeah, he wasn't there. So bookkeeper Jones paid bills all right, her own bills. There was now a trust fund shortage of $122,266 due almost entirely to embezzlement by bookkeeper Jones. Bookkeeper Jones had stolen the money over a five-month period, starting within 6 months of our first audit, and the bank would not recoup the trust account for the embezzled funds because the checks were actually signed by the salesperson owner and therefore authorized. The reality is, accounting errors will happen, and if you're unlucky, you may get an employee intent on stealing money. It is critical that you have a system in place to catch such accounting or money handling errors, or dissuade an employee from trying to take money, or at the very least, to catch them when they do try to take money. And such a system includes performing the trust account reconciliation procedures that are described in our PowerPoint presentation. In the case just described, the designated officer had just been told by our auditor that he needed to understand the accounting system used, that he needed to supervise what was going on, and that he needed to reconcile the records. He did not heed the warning, and less than a year later, over $122,000 of client money was gone. It was fully preventable, but the designated officer was just not there. Proper reconciliations and reviews would have detected the falsified accounting entries, the deleted transactions, and would have stopped the practice of allowing bookkeeper Jones to hold blank check stock. And the salesperson owner would not have had to destroy his retirement savings to correct the shortage. When the second hearing was finished, the designated officer had his license disciplined again. This time it was revoked outright, and the designated officer who followed him received a restricted license for failing to reconcile the trust account records for another 3 years where he was the responsible broker. In the hearing, the second designated officer stated, "I truly believed we were following the guidelines until Ms. Auditor pointed it out. I just didn't understand what the final step was." So the requirements described in our PowerPoint presentation are important. In my opinion, every broker who handles trust funds needs to watch it, along with the accounting staff. These oversight activities simply cannot be ignored. Okay, so thank you. I'm going to have Wayne's going to talk briefly, and then we're going to bring up Mr. Rick Fong.
I wanted to underscore the importance of what Dan Sondre just said, and that is that trust fund handling is critical, reconciliations are critical. And one of the things that I've wanted to do since I was appointed as commissioner is create a more vibrant compliance unit. And we've talked internally in our executive committee about doing that. On a compliance spectrum, you can imagine you've got the gold standard, which I think most realtors are, because you have the expertise of the Realtors Association. You've got a lawyer hotline. You've got forms. You've got an ethics code. But we have, if you think about it, there are 408,000 plus licensees. I'm not certain how many members there are of the Realtors Association, but there are lots of folks out there who are practicing real estate who just don't get it. And when I look at violations, when I look at the orders, I'm always intrigued by what we order people to do. And one of the reasons we have this trust fund training now is because I talked with Dan and said we need to do some of this. Because what we typically would do is we'd say, okay, you violated the real estate law. We're going to give you a restricted license, and now you have to take a trust fund handling course. And so I thought, why don't we have a trust fund handling course that would help people at the outset? And so if you think about this compliance spectrum, you've got people who practice on an A level, and then you have people who practice at an F level. And everyone has to be at least C level. We'd like everyone to be at the A level if possible, everyone to be at the gold standard, but we know that isn't possible. So in my view, if someone isn't malicious, if they're not willful, if they're not a bad player, if they haven't created significant public harm, I want to bring them up to a competent level of practice. And so we're looking at ways to do that in this compliance unit. We're looking at alerts that we can give licensees. We're looking at trainings like this PowerPoint presentation. If you have any ideas of things we could do, I would like to explore that with you. Obviously, the realtors have ethics alerts. They have things like that. We would like to do the same thing in the areas that we have experts in. So I wanted to say that this is sort of a new effort that we're undertaking, and we want to do more of this. Also, I want to introduce, she's going to be embarrassed now, but Veronica Kilpatrick. I actually mentioned you before, Veronica, and you weren't, as I assume you were in traffic coming up from San Diego. So, Veronica, if you'd stand up for a second. Veronica is our... Veronica manages our San Diego office, and she's also a law enforcement liaison. And like I said earlier, if you're ever down in San Diego and you'd like to meet with our staff, Veronica is the person to call. So welcome, Veronica. Thank you. And now I'd like to turn this over to Rick Fong, who's going to give the enforcement report.
Good afternoon, everybody. This is really cool because at this time of day and after all these speakers, you're all still here for me. This is really cool.
But, Rick, you're going to leave for the ice cream social, right?
Yeah. I'll make it quick so it won't melt too fast.
Yeah. Sprinkles.
I'm really grateful to be here. And, again, I want to thank you all for staying with me here. Okay. All right. I need to develop a rock star voice like Jeff here. Anyways, I want to really thank you again for all being here and having the patience to stay and listen to what I have to say. This is my 91st day on the job. I haven't been here very long, July 1st. And I got to tell you my experience here is, I got the address of the place, and there was some concerned if it was going to be ready or not for the first day on the job, but it was. Thanks to Jeff, he kept texting me, "You're good to go, you're good to go." And he was on vacation, right? And I said, "Oh, am I going to show up? They're still under construction. What am I going to do?" So he was right. The doors were open. I went in. And the first person I meet was a guy who's been there forever, Tom Poole. "Hey, how you doing?" And welcome. And, "Oh, here's your office." And walked in. Office is beautiful. Great window view. a chair, a desk, that was it, nothing else. And he goes, oh, I got something for you, here.
Yeah.
Tom, as you know, as he is, told me about the book, what it's all about, and I think he, you know, was the one who created this Bible. But so the next thing, I was overwhelmed and looked. I go, really? Because most of the my 20 years experience with the Department of Consumer Affairs, each of the entities I worked with, they all had a book such as this, but maybe like this thick, or but not like this. So I was pretty overwhelmed. And then a few days later, Wayne comes, you know, I think that same day, Wayne comes in my office, shake my hand, hey, welcome to BRE, and basically was having a nice conversation with me and basically was telling me, well, let me tell you, you know, enforcement, these are the kind of issues that we have, you know, that we're focusing on is mortgage relief, foreclosure rescue scams, loan modification scams, conversions of trust funds, unlicensed activity, unlicensed prepaid rental listing services, timeshare resale scams and fraud, short sales, and additional unlicensed activity. And we want to make, Rick, we want to have you make sure that you make the Bureau the best public protection agency in California. And I was, is that it? I got to tell you, my 91 days on the job has just been awesome. Commissioner Bell has provided me all the necessary resources other than bodies, because we're just stuck with the amount of staff that we have due to the governor's budget and due to our operating funds. We're pretty well tapped out of, you know, about hiring new people. But still, the folks that we have, the resources we have, from my 20 years of experience in state government and the Bureau, rates up there to the very top. And I honestly believe that making the Bureau as being the best public protection agency in California is achievable. I think the short amount of time that I've been there with the cooperative effort of the executive team here, they're great. And the commitment by Commissioner Bell, I want to let you know I'm committed to that mission. It is just totally awesome. I just kind of want to give you some areas that we have been working on for the last 91 days. Wayne had this vision of wanting to develop this law enforcement liaison, which is a group of folks within the Bureau, a person from each region of the state of California to be able to partner up with all the local law enforcement agencies, federal government agencies, district attorneys, to try to get together and really move along and focus on prosecuting those that commit heinous crimes in the mortgage industry, real estate industry. And so what I did was I created this law enforcement liaison, and some of the folks that Wayne introduced are here now. It's been very successful. What these folks have done, they've attended these mortgage task force with these local agencies, partnered up with them, built up a network, a great relationship, another extension of what our resources, what we have, because I think historically we were lacking on that, to where when there were serious frauds going out there, our avenues for prosecutions were weakened because of that lack of relationship. But I think we're building that. And I've gotten feedback by some of these entities, and they are committed just as well. And I think we need each other. So we're really making some headways. And one of the areas that we're really focusing, a priority that's on Commissioner Bell's list, is unlicensed activity. And I see a lot of, you know, heads nodding, yeah. Well, personally, I hate unlicensed activity. 25 years ago, I had a business that required a license. And down the street, there were people that were unlicensed. Undercut the business, unprofessional, created problems, defrauded folks. And, you know, when you have a few bad apples, it makes the whole industry look bad. And that's one of the things that is on top of my list is tries to deal with. And what we're trying to do to combat that, again, with the support of Commissioner Bell and the executive team and the resources we have, we're looking at starting up a pilot program of a dedicated team at the beginning of the year to address unlicensed activity. direct focus with law enforcement. We have a resource being merged with Department of Consumer Affairs. They have a mini law enforcement entity called Division Investigations. They've committed to assist us with that. And historically, what we've done with unlicensed activity is that we send them a letter, desist and refrain, a letter saying, hey, stop doing what you're doing. And they get the letter. Okay, so what's next? Well, again, as you all know, the unlicensed activity continues, and there's no consequence. So with the help of the Division of Investigations, we're going to be able to approach it to go criminal with these folks. It's a misdemeanor in the state of California, and we're serious about it. And I think that we're going to be having them go out if it needs to be arrested. It needs to be given a summons to go to court to answer to a judge to this. It has to be done. And I think that with this additional resource that we have, the dedicated staff to do this, as well as partnering with you all for your help to providing that information, because you've all been doing that all along with us. I'm very thankful of that. I've been doing my homework and reading, you know, going onto your website, going to reading your magazines, along with all the other stuff I'm trying to learn on our own websites. The great work that you all do and the commitment you have in your profession to make it the best it can be. So I'm really happy about that, along with not only just for unlicensed activity, but any other type of fraudulent activity that's in this industry. Another thing that I wanted to kind of inform you about is that since we merged with Department of Consumer Affairs, we had to kind of readjust our ITs and all that. And one of the areas that I was pretty surprised when I started the job was if somebody had a complaint, how do they reach us? Well, we send them a complaint. Well, we had to do something better. This age of technology, why couldn't they go online? Simple. Well, we never had that. So effective today, live as of today, we have a way to actually go to our website and go online for consumers or for you to file a complaint. It's huge. It's a great tool to use. There's a form that comes up. It's got all the information you can put in. I think it has where you can even download documents to kind of include with your complaint, but it's huge. And you don't have to use a postage stamp. You don't have to drive to the office. Just go online at your leisure. We'll file a complaint. So it's great. Another area that we're working on is most entities I've worked with in my 20 years of with the department is enforcement has always been a reactive type of enforcement. And that's when you react when something already happened. So it's just almost like it's too late. The fraud's already taken place. The consumer's already harmed. And my question has always been, why can't there always be proactive enforcement? Why can't we always try to go out there and prevent it from happening? And how do you do that? You do it by through educating. You do that by meeting with the industries as we're doing now to educate them what we're doing, what our capabilities are to do that. So we're going to be shifting, again, we only have the resource that we have, but we're you know, one of Wayne's, Commissioner Bell's vision is that we can do all these things that he stated that he wanted to address is by improving our efficiencies, streamlining the processes, getting rid of redundancies, even developing training programs for our staff, different ways using best practices for different types of vertical investigations. So with that is proactive enforcement. And what that means is instead of just whenever you get a visit from the Bureau, it's always something bad or negative. Why can't it be to where we can knock on your door and say, can we help? Is there anything that we can provide you that can be helpful to how you can conduct your business? And that's really important because from my experience of owning a business, I've had that experience. That the only time I got to saw somebody was either a government official was because they didn't fill out the form, I didn't submit the fees, didn't dot the I's across the T's. Well, it shouldn't be that way. And reading the last real estate magazine, I think Don Fault, the president, in his forum basically said that while he was doing the strategic planning for 2014-15, he realized, clicked on it, everybody has a business. And since I noticed that this expo, a lot of these seminars and these things are catered to businesses. And so I think everybody in this room wants to know and learn how to operate their business efficiently, with less headaches, with less complaints, and how you do that is as we can help. So I think at the beginning of the year, we're going to start up a new program to provide that outreach, is to come out to your folks and provide you the education. Not because there's a complaint or not because we're going to audit you. It's just going to be educational. I think that's great because, like you said, this is a lot for you all to digest and learn. There's people that's been with the Bureau for 25 years that still probably hadn't even scratched the surface. Of course, Tom Poole thinks I can because this is the first thing he gave me on my first day on the job. So that's an area that we're going to look towards as proactive enforcement. Another tool that we have that we're going to be probably at the beginning of the year, and I think you've all heard about it, is the citation and fine program. It's kind of where it's at right now. It's moving along through the administrative process to where it'll eventually be law in our part of our regulations. To where that's a tool that we can use to address those type of folks who have minor violations of their real estate law. And instead of always just, devoting a resource to hardcore investigations, we can use that as a tool as a form of disciplinary, but not as a formal disciplinary. Again, I see that as educational. And I think that most businesses, if they make a minor infraction or a minor violation, I don't see there's a need why you really have to lose your license over it. But I think they prefer that, hey, it's just like, the traffic ticket will pay the fine if we need to go driving school, but I'll get better, I'll learn from it, and we move on. I think the same kind of concept what we're going to do here, and it's been used in practice through a lot of boards and bureaus as well, and I don't see any reason why it can't be successful here, just because of the fact that I don't believe that every complaint needs to result in investigation and results in trying to take somebody's license away, because everybody makes mistakes. Those are to make the bad mistakes, fraudulent activities, out and out rip people off. Those are the ones that we need to deal with and focus on and take them out, because they are the ones who are making you all look bad. And so I'm going to challenge you, because Wayne put a pretty good challenge on me, and I'm working towards it, but I'm going to challenge you all. As many people I see in this room, as many licensees that we have out there, Wayne said, 408,000. We're going to barely scratch the surface in trying to address a lot of these issues with the big population. We'll do our darn best. But make them become your members. Because based on what I've been hearing about the programs that you have, your ethics program and the great work that you do, if you can take those people and turn them into your members, I think the real estate industry would really be a better world, better make my job a heck of a lot easier. I don't. Not that I want you to, make me lose my job over it. But hopefully by the next forum, I'm going to be able to have more stuff to tell you of the things that we're doing, the successes that we're having. Maybe getting some good stories of some of the things that I see that's come up. I'm still in training. But I'm on a fast track of training. I got great mentors to do, and I've got the fantastic staff, and you've met some of them. And I've got all the ingredients. It's just like, when you watch these Food Network channels and you have all these people, they throw these chefs in the kitchen with all these, they got all the best ingredients. Okay, now it's your turn to create this fantastic meal. Well, that's kind of what I feel like sometimes I'm doing. Although I'm being told this is what you got to make, so I can't be too creative. But I'm loving it. I'm grateful to be here. I'm looking forward to meeting with you. I'm looking for you to reach out to me and how we can do our job better as stewards and civil servants, and getting your money's worth on the hard-earned licensing fees that you pay and you renew each year, and the dedicated effort you have in your continuing education and making your profession the best as it can be. So reach out to us. Thank you. Thank you.
your opportunity to share with us your thoughts, to ask questions. And I want to just say two things. First, I'm going to answer a question that I get asked questions about all the time. The question is on ID numbers on cards. Can you have a DRE number, BRE number? We don't really care right now, as long as there's a number. We just want to see a license number. We're not going to cite anyone if it says DRE or BRE or CalBRE, as long as there's a license number so that the public can know who they're dealing with. That's number one. Number two is we have a staff of about 335 people statewide. That's not a lot of folks to handle all of the issues that we see. But with your help, with the partnerships that we've forged with you and others, we think that that will help us make the industry better, will help the marketplace have a more level playing field, and we want to see people follow the law, and we invite you to help us make certain that that happens. So with that, I'll take the first question. Yes, sir.
Hello, Alan Wagner, Sacramento broker. Question, you said that we started today, you implemented the online part of complaints.
Yes.
Is that going to add so much more that you're not going to be able to get to them, or do you think it will actually increase the response time to them?
Not certain whether it's going to add anything. It's a way to facilitate getting the information to us.
A great product. We've all been wanting that.
Right.
Sure, like that.
And for a while, we were looking at some hybrid where people could complain through the Department of Consumer Affairs website, and then that would come to us. We'll see as time goes on whether it's going to increase the complaints coming to us. Obviously, the faster someone can get us information, if we can get the supporting materials, that's great. The one thing that I always add when I answer questions about complaints is we need all of the relevant information so we can do the investigation. And if you do complain about somebody, we want to get a good phone number, good contact information for a real live witness. Because so often what we see is an investigation that's done, and then as we go forward toward a hearing, we can't find a witness, or the person who was the complainant said, well, I really don't want to testify. Then our case goes away. So if you can help us with those complaints, that would help. Thank you, sir. Yes.
Wayne, if I may add to what you're asking, and what I believe in, to your question, yes, it will probably create and facilitate a quicker way to address your complaints. One of the things I didn't touch on, I think it's really important that we currently have now, is the advocacy program that Wayne had discussed earlier, or we're calling it a complaint resolution program, to where, again, not every complaint results in an investigation. So what we're going to do is possibly start up a pilot program of dedicated folks. So we have two individuals here now. They're very professional, is to address those type of complaints that you said and see if, in fact, they are they can be resolved at a low level and worked out between the complainant and the person who they're complaining about, and put that kind of a program in place. And typically what we find, and from my experience of running a statewide complaint resolution program, is that you can get those resolved within 30 to 60 days as opposed to waiting a whole year where each complaint results into an investigation. So I can see down the future, you know, based on the vehicle that we have now to get complaints, putting together a team that we already have now is just fine-tuning it to address complaints and look at complaints a little bit differently and triaging those type of complaints to where we will.
And I want to say a model that I like is good community-based policing. We don't want to be bad cops. We want to be good cops who know the community, where we can walk and say, okay, put that away, do it this way, or you'll be cited. And if they say, we don't understand how to do it, we'll get someone who can help them understand. But we're not out there to arrest people. We're not out there to discipline everybody. We want to be of assistance where we can. Where we see someone really violating the law, we want to go after them. Those are the folks we want to get. The bad players, we want to shine a light on them. If we can get them, great. If we can't, we want the other police agencies we work with to get them. But we want to be of assistance in the real estate community. Okay. Yes, ma'am.
Good afternoon. I'm Pat Douglas, a real estate broker in the Los Angeles area. And I was sitting with another broker at lunch, and we were wondering this. A lot of times we take in an offer, and we get a copy of a check payable to escrow. Now, how? That's just a copy. Are we liable to have that logged in and everything as if it were a live check?
You know who I'm going to ask to answer the question? She's shaking her head. Is Ashley Summer Bakatich here, who used to do a whole bunch of escrow stuff. Do you have any thoughts on this, whether they have to have a copy of the actual check or whether a copy is good enough? Right. Right.
That's good.
Very good. Thank you, Summer. Thank you, Dan.
Follow her.
Pardon? Dan?
So if you just receive a copy of a check that was supposedly sent to escrow, you don't need to log that in. Now, if it's your transaction, you may want to verify by contacting escrow, okay, this is what's happening in this transaction. But no, if you don't actually receive the check, you don't need to log it in. You didn't receive the check.
That's right. You never had possession of it.
You see that copy, that's being held by the agent that's writing the
okay.
Copy.
It's,
the check will then be forwarded to the escrow, but not to the listing office.
Right. So you didn't receive it. The other agent has the actual check. They need to log it in. You do not.
That's correct.
Okay. Sir.
Bob Hunt, broker from San Clemente, California. I want to address the issue of fictitious business names for agent teams.
Yes.
And I appreciate the department, you know, coming to grips with this and coming up with a policy. We're finding pushback from agents, and I know that's not your problem, but a lot of agents don't want to give up their name to the broker,
right?
Because Joe Smith team now belongs to the broker, and if Joe Smith leaves, you know, he wants to take his name. Are you hearing about that?
This is an issue that we realize has been out there for a long, long time. It's like the highway patrol when they're told, keep people from driving over 70 miles an hour. They're going to drive more than 70 miles an hour. We know their teams. Now, our starting point for this is team names that include a salesperson, we believe, are a misrepresentation to the public unless they include the broker's name, because it's salespeople suggesting to the public that they can operate a real estate entity or a company irrespective of a broker. The entire basis upon which the real estate law is based is you have brokers who supervise salespeople. We have a regulation which says a fictitious business name must be registered with us. The law says that salespeople cannot operate independently. So what we were trying to do with this article, and we haven't finished our regulation yet because we're going to have further discussions about this, is figure out a way to give a safe harbor to those salespeople who want to operate under their names. And the requirement, though, is that the broker's name also has to be included somewhere on the cards, somewhere on the advertisements, and that the broker owns the fictitious business name. Because I believe, and the executive team here believes, that salespeople cannot operate independently. It's like paralegals operating the legal office of so-and-so. The suggestion is that they can practice independent of lawyers, and sometimes they can under certain exemptions from the State Bar Practice Act. But the deal with us is salespeople cannot operate independently away from a real estate broker. They have to be supervised by and paid through the broker. And I can tell you, in the area I live, in Northern California, I walk around the area, I drive around the area, and I've seen so many signs where I'll say the so-and-so team or the so-and-so group, and none of those folks are brokers. And it's troubling to me because the suggestion is their broker is irrelevant. And I know that some brokers feel that's not the way to go either, because it's basically lack of control over the salespeople. But we don't have a fix right yet. We're talking about it. We'd like as much input as we can get. But the thinking right now is that we will allow salespeople to have a fictitious business name, but that will be owned by the broker because that's really the only way they can practice.
Let me ask a second follow-up question. If it were possible that a salesperson refused to comply with that and to have the broker list register the fictitious business name, and there were an enforcement or something, would it go against the salesperson only, or would the broker be involved as well?
In my own view, and this is something we'd have to talk about, I would start with the salespeople immediately because obviously they don't understand. They cannot operate outside of the brokerage agreement. They're representing to the public that they are able to practice without any mention of a broker. And so my view would be that we'd go after the salespeople. The broker, obviously, what we see is it's lack of control, basically, over the salespeople. And I understand there are many salespeople who have very successful teams throughout the state, and they've basically said, we're a known commodity. We should be able to practice as a group. And I don't deny that. But the broker has to be identified somewhere, and the broker has to be responsible, in my view. And that's my view right now, and I think that's the prevailing view of our executive committee. We're going to be looking at this some more. We're still working on the regulations. And when the regulations are done, by the way, they're just a draft. And we want you to be involved in looking at them, giving us your thoughts. And we're not – also, I just want to say we're not one of these government agencies that does regs in the dark. We're going to talk with CAR. We want you to look at these. We want every stakeholder to look at these and say, okay, this either works or it doesn't work. But the starting point for us is that salespeople cannot operate independently and separately from their broker.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. A couple of just quick questions here. Forgive the dual part question. First is, can you guys provide some clarity on Assembly Bill 1718 in reference to the 2 years of full-time experience that's now needed or a bachelor's with a major or minor in real estate, only because I feel like a lot of people that are going to be applying for the broker's exam may use, for example, some unlicensed but equivalent experience. And it seems to be a bit of ambiguity in terms of what the department or bureau will accept or won't accept in terms of unlicensed real estate activity.
I'm going to ask Tom to answer that because he's over licensing, but I can tell you that the statute's pretty clear. I believe the California Association of Realtors actually was the sponsor of the law because the membership wanted to make certain that people could not get a broker's license without having the requisite experience or specialized education at schools that have a major or minor in real estate. So we are pretty strictly construing the language in the statute because it doesn't give us any wiggle room. But as far as equivalency, I'm going to ask Tom just to briefly talk about that.
It is ambiguous. And so the easy answer for me is if you're going to use some sort of equivalent experience, you just need to provide it, and we look at those on a case-by-case basis. So there's no regulation or anything I can really point to say.
But Tom, what's not ambiguous, though, is the language of the code.
Not in terms of education. You're exactly right. What I'm talking about is the equivalent experience, the 2 years.
Right.
And so we do have a process and a form where you can provide that, and our staff will look at that and tell you whether it's going to qualify. But it literally is on a case-by-case basis.
Right, exactly. I just have had some friends of mine and colleagues that have it worked, and then somebody else that may have had – maybe they just didn't package it properly or they didn't explain.
Or maybe it just didn't count.
Or so, right. That's also quite possible. Absolutely. So, but no disagreement there.
Yeah,
I agree.
Yeah. All right. So it is on a case-by-case basis.
Right. The second thing here real quick, has the Bureau considered if there's a threshold of trust fund amounts received to require, let's say, $1 million a month or $500,000 a month to have brokers, just people that are handling a lot of trust funds or a certain number of transactions to submit audited financial statements with some degree of regularity, just to be proactive in terms of people that take that much trust funds into their trust accounts.
Yeah, I'll take it.
Okay.
That's an awesome idea. And
I do not want to spearhead it.
What you're talking about would be a legislative change. And what's interesting about your concept, we already have that in the law. It applies to brokers that do certain types of mortgage lending, the hard money lenders. they're required to provide quarterly and annual reports to the department. And it's a wonderful tool for us to look at these guys that are doing large volume of loans using private money. And it's a very effective regulation, a very effective tool. In order to spearhead something like that, it would take a legislative change. And if it's something as a group you're interested in, you'd have much more success sponsoring it through an association effort legislatively. But the notion has been adopted with a certain group, and the reason it was adopted with a certain group is there were, going back to the early 80s, so many trust fund conversions and losses and hard money that something had to be done. And that's exactly what you're talking about was done, quarterly and annual reports to the department on their trust fund handling. It also includes a review of an annual review of a by CPA of the books. So it's there. If you want to try to expand it, it's going to have to be done legislatively.
The other thing I just want to add to this is when we see trust fund conversions, we're seeing a lot of them in property management, the escrow area, and we're looking at tightening the regulations on some of the broker-controlled escrows, and then in hard money. The governor just signed a bill, and it's going to go into effect in January, that makes it a violation of the real estate law to alter or destroy records that have to be maintained. Dan can tell you stories that would raise the hair on your neck of real estate licensees who will send us bank records, and they're just completely made up. Right. They look like they're real, but then when we get the real bank records, they don't look at all alike.
Right. Thank you for your response.
Good afternoon. I'm Paula Swain from Sacramento, and I'm a broker. First of all, your building is beautiful. I've been there, and I'm very, very impressed.
Thank you.
Also, we actually had a couple people from BRE come to the SAR and actually speak to a group, and they were phenomenal and really did help answer a lot of questions.
Thank you.
Now, my question, having said all that, this is like herding cats. Lots of rumors, for lack of a better description, of what BRE is going to require regarding emails and files, Facebook in files, Twitter in files. I had an attorney, a very well-known attorney actually, tell us that BRE not only is going to require emails now in files, now they're going to be looking at Facebook and Twitter.
I know what you're talking about. What's interesting is we wrote an article about this back in the spring bulletin. And this is there's no earth-shaking stuff here. There's no magic here. What the article said was, under 10148, a real estate broker has to maintain records regarding transactions. And then there was a discussion about records. And the discussion said, if you have Twitter communications, like you say, great, the deal's closed as of such and such, that's really a record that ought to be maintained with regard to the transaction. If they're emails, those should be maintained. And so... And I know this lawyer wrote something as if, like, we're going to jump, we're going to somehow sideswipe you and do something horrendous here. It was simply an article that we wanted to get out there that was informative to say that when you think about records with regard to a transaction, they would include any sort of written communication or something that can be produced as evidence of what happened in that deal. It would be a telex, it would be a fax, it would be Twitter communication, and that's all. I mean, we're not going to be going out and saying, okay, let's see your Twitter account.
Right.
Where's your Facebook account? I mean, I wouldn't even know how to look at that stuff. But that's the point. It was more educational than anything else, and in some ways, it was more an offer of a help, in our view, to licensees to say that if you're ever, think about it, if you're ever sued, And they say, when did the deal close? And you say, well, I sent a tweet on this. You need to have some record of that.
So if you have like we have quite often now Facebook has advertising for listings. Is that something
we're not going to be looking at that unless someone said there's a misrepresentation or false advertising. But this was more in connection with when you're asked to keep records with regard to particular transactions, what do the records contain? And it's not just a contract. It can be an email. It might be a fax. It might be a tweet or whatever else you would use to confirm the transaction. or to reflect the transaction.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. I can't believe it. You know, the ice cream social is ongoing. Yes.
Sorry, I'm Jeff Stokes. I'm a broker for 30 years. My whole career has been in real estate.
Mm-hmm.
But one of my pet peeves is the part-time agents or the agents that just sell one house a year for themselves. Is there anything about increasing the continuing education or require them to have E&O insurance or something that I have to pay, and they just come in and seem to, I don't know if it's a concern or not, but it's always been a concern.
It's something that we look at, we discuss. I'm just not certain how we would get there if we wanted to make that change. This is something, and I just want to say something here. We oftentimes see issues, and sometimes we're asked to give advice on legislative enactments and what we think would be good changes for the law. But typically, the law changes come from the advocacy groups. It would come from the California Association of Realtors. And I have people say to me, shouldn't there be more stringent pre-licensure education? Shouldn't there be more stringent continuing education? And obviously there's ebbs and flows, but we really don't take a position on that. We're the regulator. We're asked to enforce the law. So that's not something that we've looked at, but I invite you to take this up with the legislative group at CAR and have that discussion. Because I've heard that. Obviously, there are people who do real estate all the time, gold standard, and then other people are out there, and they may not be the stellar practitioners that they should be. And I'm just not certain how to address that. We address it by citing them if they violate the law. But obviously, there could be ways to enhance the protections of the public. But that's something I invite you to talk with CAR about, and then they will talk with us, and we'll see if there's something that we can do. Thank you. Yes, sir.
I just want to say that I really appreciate your meeting today. I'm Larry Kleesner with Region 14, and I only wish I had it on a video so when I go to my broker manager's meeting, I could play it with you guys all talking as you talk, because it's not enforcement's wonderful. I mean, I'm power law enforcement. But the way you put it, it was just beautiful, you know, to be able to help rather than be a punitive issue. And I think you guys are great. I appreciate you.
Thank you very much. Thank you for being here. Thank you.
Hey, Jeff.